This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent, wherever they may live upon the earth. Great to be with you again, and today, as you know, Lebanon is in agony. It is a slaughter, ladies and gentlemen, nothing more than a slaughter. As I said in my previous broadcast, it is like a fly swatter, Israel, swatting a fly, the Lebanese people. They have no real defense. The Israelis just running roughshod. They're destroying buildings, schools, hospitals. They order people out from the regions where they live, and then they bomb the convoys of civilians as they flee. You are witnessing a modern-day war crime. A crime of huge proportions, and yet the world is mostly silent. Why? Because the people committing this crime are that privileged few, that chosen people, supposedly, who have a right to do anything because of supposed wrongs that were done against them in the past. And ladies and gentlemen, there have been wrongs against the Jewish people. There have been wrongs against every people on the planet, but it's true also that Jewish extremists have also committed crimes in the past. And what's going on in terms of Israel and Lebanon is nothing more than an old replay of Jewish supremacist ideology and callous disregard for human rights and values for any other people other than Jews themselves. Today I'm going to continue on with my reading, my spoken word reading, from Jewish supremacism. And today we begin part one of chapter four. So today it's chapter four, which is entitled Jews, Communism, and Civil Rights. The eccentric woman in the Citizens Council office who railed about Jews and communism obviously had some of her facts straight. The facts were inescapable. Communism and Zionism were born from the same Jewish soul, personified in Moses Hess. I slowly became aware of a dual morality permeating Jewish-Gentile relations. Jews practice one morality for themselves and preach another for non-Jews. Judaic morality is racial pride, solidarity, tradition, and self-interest. They preach diversity and liberalism for their perceived competitors, while they themselves preach racism and exclusivity. If such dualism does not exist, how could the Jewish-dominated American media, 1, support the Nation of Israel, which promotes passionate Judaism in schools, while opposing even the singing of Christmas carols in American public schools? 2, support the Nation of Israel, which has strictly segregated schools, communities, and facilities for Jews and Arabs, while condemning segregated schools and housing in America and South Africa? 3, support the Nation of Israel with its restrictive Jews-only immigration laws, while subverting American attempts to curtail even illegal immigration? 4, support the Nation of Israel, which allows every Jewish citizen to carry a machine gun, if so desired, while advocating strict gun control for American citizens. Supports the Nation of Israel, which openly states its mission to preserve the Jewish people and heritage, while condemning Europeans, or any other people, who dare to advocate the preservation of the Western culture and heritage in America. 6, always depict the historical relations between Jews and Gentiles, with the Gentiles as evildoers and Jews as innocent victims, while condemning Gentiles that simply dare to defend themselves from such ethnic slanders. The moral hypocrisy became obvious to me. powerful Jews advocate one morality about racial pride for Jews and an opposite agenda for Gentiles. If their policies of solidarity are morally good for them, why would they not be morally good for us as well? Why the double standard? If by their own arguments, white racists are morally reprehensible, why are not Jewish supremacists reprehensible as well? While Herzl and other Zionists feverishly gathered worldwide Jewish support for the establishment of an exclusively Jewish state, Jewish activists were busy trying to negate the Christian component of American culture and remove even Christmas carols from our schools. While they trumpet their belief that they are a, quote, chosen people above all others and celebrate a unique people defined by heritage from Abraham to the present, they tell European Americans that any sort of race consciousness is evil. While they established a Jewish nation where citizenship is based almost exclusively on heredity of the Jewish people, Jewish anthropologists promote the idea that the European race doesn't even exist. Palestinians are said to be evil for simply having the desire to have their own nation run by their own people, despite the same desire was the founding principle of Israel itself. Even though Jews devotedly support their own exclusively Jewish-run state of Israel, they work feverishly to undermine the white control and character of America through massive non-European immigration. They consistently work for diversity and pluralism in every nation of the world except for their Jewish world center in Israel. While Israel prohibits Gentiles from owning certain forms of media in Israel, they boldly move to gain control of the great majority of the mass media in America. Communist Ideology and Race Section. Maddie Smith told me that the Jews have the leading roles in the efforts to destroy the very underpinnings of our heritage. I had read that Jews were the leaders of the academic movement promoting the idea that nations and races are artificial entities. In looking into the foundations of racial egalitarianism, I found that adherents of international communism pioneered the modern notions of universalism. Across the world, communism allied itself with racial and national minorities and their struggle for, quote, liberation from imperialism, colonialism, and oppression. I soon found out that Jews dominated the international communist movement in modern times, just as they had led Bolshevism in Russia early in the 20th century. Jewish scribe Nathan Glazer stated matter-of-factly that in the 1960s and 70s, the Jews comprised half of all the active communists in the United States and four out of five of its leaders. Two Jews, Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman, led the Marxist-oriented Yippie movement, and they were two of the five Jewish members of the revolutionary Chicago Seven group, tried for the violent disruption of the 1968 Democratic Convention. I read a book called Behind Communism, and I was surprised to discover that at least four out of five of all those caught and convicted of communist espionage and treason in the United States and Canada were in fact Jews. Probably the most infamous act of treason in American history was the theft of atomic bomb secrets by Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. They were part of the Fuchs Gold spy ring that operated in and around the Manhattan Project and other branches of the American Atomic Weapons Program. Seven members of the Fuchs Gold ring pled guilty to charges associated with espionage. They were Klaus Fuchs, Harry Gold, David Greenglass, Abraham Brothman, Miriam Moskowitz, Sidney Weinbaum, and Alfred Slack. Another suspect, Morton Sobel, fled to Mexico, but Mexican authorities turned him over to the United States to face trial and subsequent conviction. A jury also convicted the Rosenbergs, and they were executed. Of the 10 spies most responsible for the selling out of our atomic secrets to the Soviets, only one, Alfred Slack, was a Gentile. Other major spy cases included the Amerasia case, the Gerhard Eisler case, the Judith Copeland case, the Alger Hiss case. Jews figured prominently in these cases and made up a clear majority of the defendants. The only prominent non-Jewish spy was Alger Hiss. In the Hollywood 10 case, the House of Representatives convicted 10 of Hollywood's leading film writers of contempt of Congress. They appeared before the House Committee on Un-American Activities and refused to testify when asked that they were communists. Jewish publications alleged that the committee ruined the writers for no apparent reason. Recently, a number of movies have been made defending the Hollywood Ten as unjustly and unfairly persecuted. Yet six of the ten proved to be dues-paying members of the Communist Party. The other four had records of many Communist Front activities and connections. Nine of the ten were of Jewish heritage. While Jewish Marxists pursued the political part of the, quote, civil rights, unquote, effort, they pushed just as hard in the academic realm. Until the 1930s, the biological sciences recognized the different races of mankind as surely as they did the different species and subspecies of the animal kingdom. That is, as commentator Kevin Strom says, until the egalitarian political wind blew into American academia, propelled by a clever, connected, and well-heeled minority with an agenda. I began to realize that African Americans were not the primary proponents of racial miscegenation. Most African Americans, as is true of all peoples, are proud of their distinctiveness, although they certainly desired economic and social advancement. The most popular black leader in the early part of the 20th century was the black separatist Marcus Garvey, who sought repatriation for blacks back to Africa and the foundation of a new black nation. Against this movement of black separatism and the efforts of European Americans to preserve Western heritage, arose a minority that sought to sabotage both agendas. Even today, despite the best efforts of the Jewish media to defame him, the most popular African-American leader is the Muslim minister Louis Farrakhan, who unashamedly seeks the preservation of his own race. Section, a movement hostile to all nationalities. Franz Boas is the accepted father of the modern egalitarian school of anthropology. He was a Jewish immigrant from Germany with little formal training in the anthropological field, having done his doctoral thesis on the colors of water. Boas introduced what he called cultural anthropology to the discipline. Until his arrival, anthropology officially belonged to the physical sciences. Boas effectively divided anthropology into separate disciplines of cultural and physical anthropology. Early physical anthropologists were truly race scientists because they studied man and his evolutionary development through the study of the measurable physical characteristics of the human races, past and present. Any good physical anthropologist could pick up a human skull, based on its characteristics, quickly identify the race of the specimen. Of course, this physiological knowledge was vital in sorting out the unearthed remnants of early man and piecing together man's prehistory and evolutionary development. Cultural anthropology dealt more with the different contemporary cultures of mankind and culturally related questions of antiquity and prehistory, making it a far less precise science and one open to more wide interpretation. Surprisingly, before he became such a prominent anthropologist, Boas expressed his acceptance of racial differences in mental characteristics. In the mind of primitive man, he wrote, quote, differences of structure must be accompanied by differences of function, physiological as well as psychological, and as we found clear evidence of differences in structure between races, so we must anticipate that the differences in mental characteristics will be found. Both of Boas' parents were radical socialists in the revolutionary movement that swept over Europe in 1870. In his biography of Boas, his student Melville Hershkovitz wrote that Boas' political sympathies leaned toward a variety of socialism. The United States House of Representatives cited Boas' involvement with 44 Communist Front organizations. Coinciding with the rise of Nazism in Germany and the increasing influence of racially aware anthropologists in the world scientific community, Boas began to marshal his anthropological influence in service of his political sympathies. He began to advance the quack idea that there is really no such thing as individual human races. He argued that although they had variations of skin colors and features, the groups called races possessed little difference genetically. He claimed that the immediate environment alone created all the superficial differences. By 1938, Boas dropped the above quotation from the new edition of his book. He gathered many Jewish disciples around him, including Gene Wellfish, Isidore Chain, Melville Hershkovitz, Otto Kleinberg, and Ashley Montague. He also had among his followers the African-American scientist Kenneth B. Clark and two women, Ruth Benedict and Margaret Mead. Mead later wrote her famous book on Samoa, Coming of Age in Samoa, suggesting that indiscriminate sexual relations would lessen teenage traumas and problems. Her opus, by the way, was later soundly refuted by Derek Freeman, who showed that Mead had falsified her data on Samoa. Boaz and his entire cadre of disciples had extensive communist connections. He repeatedly proclaimed that he was in a holy war against racism, and he died suddenly during a luncheon where he once again, and for the last time, stressed the need to fight racism. Boaz and his comrades gained control over the anthropology departments of most universities by encouraging their egalitarian comrades to always support their own and their academic appointments. While traditional anthropologists had no axe to grind and no sacred cause to champion, Boaz and his followers embarked on a holy mission to extirpate racial knowledge from the modern academic establishment. They succeeded, of course, much with the allies of Jewish power, both in media and in administration around the United States and elsewhere. Whenever egalitarians achieved positions of influence or power, they aided their comrades' advance in the teaching departments of the colleges and academic departments they administered. They consistently assisted their co-religionists, as well as Gentile egalitarians, in getting professorships and research appointments and promotions. Similar collusion took place in the ranks and on the boards of anthropological associations and journals. However, the coup de grace was the massive support given the egalitarian dogma by the media establishment, which was overwhelmingly in Jewish hands. Racial equality was, and still is, presented to the public as scientific fact, opposed only by the bigoted and the ignorant. Egalitarian writers such as Ashley Montague and others received great praise in magazines, newspapers, and later on in television. Whether one was a Jew or a Gentile, professing a belief in racial equality became essential dogma for anyone who wanted to advance in anthropology or any other part of the academic world. Adherence to the politically correct line of thought led to prestige and acclaim, money, and success. Racial truth-telling led to personal attack, dead-end careers, and often even to economic hardship. Ashley Montague became the best-known spokesman for the equality hoax, superseding Boaz as the most popular exponent of anti-racism. His well-modulated British accent and aristocratic name added instant credibility to his opinions about racial equality. I can still, after 30 years, remember his impressive appearances on the Today television program. His book, Race, Man's Most Dangerous Myth, became the Bible of equality, and it profoundly impressed me before I had a chance to read the other side of the issue. Montague's birth name was actually not Montague at all, but Israel Ehrenberg. In a brilliant exercise of psychological camouflage, Ehrenberg changed his name a number of times, finally settling on not simply an Anglo-Saxon moniker, but the name Montague, which is one of Britain's most aristocratic and oldest medieval-titled families. On the way to the top, it was important to put the blinders on Gentiles about the Jewish race and advantages to the Jewish group inherent in multiculturalism. Once their domination was in place, they began to construct a fascinating dichotomy. At almost the same moment they said that race and ethnicity had no real importance in society, they began to talk about the importance of Jewish ethnography, even to the point of discussing the Jewish domination of anthropology. By the late 1990s, Jewish writers began to write brazenly about their domination of American anthropology. In a 1997 edition of American Anthropologist, which is published by the American Anthropological Association, Jewish scholar Gayla Frank writes that egalitarian American anthropology is so thoroughly Jewish that it should be classed as part of Jewish history. Frank goes on to admit that anthropology is in the service of a social agenda and that her essay focuses on Jewish anthropologists who are, quote, concerned with turning multiculturalist theories into agendas for activism, unquote. The same breed of anthropologists who so fervently declare that there is no such thing as race when it comes to blacks and whites are now hypocritically affirming the unique genetic homogeneity of Jews. Moreover, increasing numbers of Jewish anthropologists have come out of the closet in celebration of their special genetic and cultural heritage. Unless one speaks about the unique qualities of the chosen people, egalitarianism still dominates America's academic climate. Richard Lewontin, Leon Kamen, Jared Diamond, and Stephen Jay Gould are its four self-acknowledged Jews and the leading academic exponents of egalitarianism. Stephen Jay Gould has recently passed on, though. In spite of an avalanche of fresh scientific data proving the vital role of genes in producing individual and group differences, racial egalitarianism is still the holy writ of anthropology and human psychology as characterized by the popular media. The writings of Lewontin, Kamen, Gould, Rose, Diamond, and other egalitarians frequently appear in the pages of magazines such as the Smithsonian, Natural History, Nature, Discover, Time, Newsweek, and other wide circulation publications. Television programs often interview them as authorities on the subject of race and seldom allow any contradiction from academic opponents of egalitarianism. Most of the leading egalitarian spokesmen are self-described Marxists, a detail that the media never seems to mention. Imagine if one of their opponents was a self-proclaimed Nazi. I suspect that that fact would always be cited when their ideas were mentioned. Perhaps the best way to prove the purposeful deception utilized by Jewish egalitarians is by exposing the blatantly hypocritical writings of one of the leading lights of Jewish egalitarianism, Jared Diamond. In the New York Review of Books, Diamond has praised Cavalli Sforza for, quote, demolishing scientists' attempts to classify human populations into races in the same way that they classify birds and other species into races. But in a recent Natural History magazine article, Diamond says that genetic studies prove that Jews differ from non-Jews. He makes the startling assertion, quote, there are also practical reasons for interest in Jewish genes. The state of Israel has been going to much expense to support immigration and job retraining of Jews who were persecuted minorities in other countries. That immediately poses the problem of defining who is a Jew, unquote. So Diamond says that there are no real differences between the major races of mankind, but that it's indeed both possible and desirable to distinguish the far less pronounced differences between Jews and non-Jews. The same man who proposes open borders for America says how wonderful it is that Israel will now be able to genetically identify Jews so that it can enforce its racially exclusive immigration laws. A good example of the Jewish strategy can be seen in their hopes for the widespread assimilation of the Palestinian people into other cultures and peoples. Palestinians are, of course, overwhelmingly Muslim and Christian, two faiths that are generally universalistic in their outlook as opposed to the racial supremacist view of Judaism. As the Palestinians that were driven out of what is now Greater Israel have filtered into Western countries, many have intermarried and assimilated into the populations of their host countries. Jewish supremacists correctly predict that assimilated Palestinians will tend to have weaker ties and less commitment to their Palestinian heritage and the cause of Palestinian freedom. What applies to Palestinians applies to all people that Jewish supremacists see as their enemies and their competitors. That is why they have consistently sought to break down the desire to preserve the racial heritage, culture, and solidarity in all people other than themselves. Egalitarianism is for Gentile consumption only, while racial distinction and supremacism remain the soul and sinew of Judaism. Despite the well-organized part of Jewish history, control of anthropology, the scientific affirmation of race is growing so quickly that the popular egalitarians may not be able to hold back the scientific tide much longer. There has never been a greater disparity between scientific and popular understanding. Of course, it is a strategic necessity for Jewish supremacists to break down any feeling of ethnic solidarity, culture, or loyalty among their opponents. If other peoples have strong ties to their own identity, heritage, and culture, they naturally would not so easily submit to Jewish domination. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of part one of chapter five, Jews, Communism, and Civil Rights. The next part will begin with the Freudian assault. So that's going to be an interesting chapter, and I think that you're going to enjoy and find this chapter valuable in many, many ways to begin to understand how the Jews have preached one sort of morality for themselves, an entirely different morality for the rest of the world. They have broken down our own sense of heritage, culture, solidarity, tradition, values, while they themselves have worked hard to preserve their traditions, their values, their heritage. As a result, that has led to their greater strengths and our continuing greater weaknesses in some areas. We are not acting for our interests in so many areas because we feel no sense of tie, no sense of heritage, which they have worked so hard and through their incredible influence in both media and government to break down. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been David Duke, and I look forward to being with you tomorrow with part two of the fifth chapter of Jewish Supremacism, Jews, Communism, and Civil Rights.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddukedave.com.